You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's a Vanity Fair spotlight by Josh Duboff. Sitting Pretty, photographed by Brian Adams. Pretty Woman, the musical, stars Samantha Barks and Steve Casey, photographed in New York City. There are few movies as resonant in the pop culture universe as Garry Marshall's Pretty Woman, the 1990 romantic comedy that catapulted Julia Roberts to superstardom. Now, nearly three decades later, Tony Award-winning director and choreographer Jerry Mitchell, Kinky Boots, is bringing Pretty Woman the musical to Broadway. Samantha Barks, a 27-year-old British actress, best known for playing Eponine in the 2012 film version of Les Miserables, will try to fill Roberts' high, high heels. Steve Casey, who won the Best Actor Tony for the 2012 musical Once, will take on the Richard Gere stoic billionaire role. As if there were not enough ingredients for success here, Canadian pop icon Brian Adams is responsible for the music. After a five-week run in Chicago this March, the show, produced by Paula Wagner, is set to open in New York this summer. Barks said she is attempting, as best she can, to put Roberts out of her head as she approaches the project. "I'm trying to be true to the character and trying to remove the pressure of Roberts, who obviously is so well-loved for this performance," she said. "You have to try to do your own thing and use your own instincts to read the character like you're reading the script for the first time." In 2014, Marshall said in an interview that Disney, which owns half the rights to Pretty Woman, had wanted to switch the Julia Roberts character from a prostitute to a model, a change which did not end up taking place. "And given the current political climate, a story like Pretty Woman, a tale, yes, of two lonely souls finding love against the odds, is particularly necessary," Casey believes. "We're in the Breaking Bad world, you know, where everybody wants the flawed characters and the anti-heroes, and that's great," he said. "But I think with the state of the world that we're in right now, art sometimes has to go to the other side. So, a great story like this, a fun, beautiful fairy tale, is just what we need at this time, when life is so heavy." Thank you. Here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco, Jim Broadbent, set to star in Paddington 2, The Voyage of Dr. Doolittle, and King Lear. The British actor, whose career spans nearly half a century, talks Brexit, losing his sense of smell, and the appeal of an ever-changing motto. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Weeping with laughter. What is your greatest fear? Incapacity. Which living person do you most admire? The Obamas are impressive. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Indolence. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Certainty. What is your greatest extravagance? Jackets. What is your favorite journey? Any journey by boat. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Cool. On what occasion do you lie? I suppose when I exaggerate and when I withhold. What do you dislike most about your appearance? I've come to terms with it. Which living person do you most despise? Too many people I could do without, but to despise them all would be a huge and negative waste of energy. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? I don't know. What is your greatest regret? Being hurtful. What or who is the greatest love of your life? ARB. When and where were you happiest? It happens all the time, but childhood holidays on the North Norfolk coast were a kind of bliss. Which talent would you most like to have? Fluency in even one other language would be fantastic. What is your current state of mind? Thoughtful. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I'd like to get my sense of smell back. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? That would be presumptuous. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Having made a living out of playing. What is your most treasured possession? My collection of hand-painted Valentine cards from my wife. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? I imagine losing one's life partner would be down there, and Brexit. Where would you like to live? In Europe. What is your favorite occupation? Playing. What is your most marked characteristic? That I don't have one. What is the quality you most like in a man? Humor. What is the quality you most like in a woman? Humor. What do you most value in your friends? Their humor and that they are smarter than I, but not by too much. Who are your favorite writers? Charles Dickens, Elmore Leonard. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Yossarian. Who are your heroes in real life? Nurses and doctors working in war zones. What is it that you most dislike? The suffering caused by fundamentalists of any stripe. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? Probably stationary. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? An owl, or maybe a heron, some sort of deliberate bird. How would you like to die? This is an issue I have yet to address. I suppose it will depend on the available options. What is your motto? Keep changing your motto. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Jim Broadbent.
Thank you.
All About Steve. Leaving the White House last August, Steve Bannon amped up his war on the GOP. As the true leader of the Trump revolution, he'd throw as many bombs as he could. But his comments and Michael Wolff's fire and fury blew up in his face, ending his ties to Trump and his reign at Breitbart News. After a week on the road with Bannon, Gabriel Sherman explains why the explosion was inevitable. Illustrations by Barry Blitt. Great White Hunter, Bannon took populist, nationalist aim at the GOP establishment. And in the two opening illustrations, Bannon is shown in one, rifle in hand, posing in front of an elephant. He is killed, with a stampede of elephants charging toward him. And in the other photo illustration, he's shown about to be guillotined. Steve Bannon had just boarded a private jet when the first ripples from the coming storm appeared. Bannon scanned a text message on his phone from former White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus. Reince is sweating the Michael Wolff book, Bannon said. He saw the press release, and it's all about dog-eat-dog. Bannon just chuckled. He didn't mind chaos. He even liked it. He saw himself as a revolutionary, and revolutions happen when things fall apart. Only days into the new year, Wolff's explosive book, Fire and Fury, with Bannon as its central source, was rocking the West Wing like an IED, and Bannon was its first casualty. But in fact, Bannon had partly foreseen this situation, all but the part about ending his own career. As we taxied toward the runway, Bannon explained why, despite his competition with Trump, he needs to defend him at all cost. Trump's at war with the permanent political class in D.C. I have this whole theory about the nullification of the 2016 election by the Democrats, the opposition party, and the Republican establishment, he said. Can you believe they had that Senate committee meeting that talked about the president's ability to use nuclear weapons? It's unreal. Bannon had long considered the possibility that somehow Donald Trump's presidency, whether from his own errors or mental slippage or some sort of establishment coup, or most likely some combination, would be taken from him. And Bannon had increasingly come to believe that he, himself, was the true custodian of the Trumpian revolution. He'd said as much. The Trump presidency that we fought for and won is over, he told the Weekly Standard when he was fired from the administration in August. Privately, but prolifically, he handicapped Trump's chances. The caption appearing with the guillotine illustration is the headman. Bannon cheerfully engineered his own execution. In October, I reported that he told a friend Trump had lost a step and had only a 30% chance of completing his term. Instead, it was Bannon who had his career taken from him. Within days of the publication of Wolff's book, Bannon was excoriated by Trump, dumped by his financial backer, Rebecca Mercer, and forced out of Breitbart. Bannon's stunning fall came just 11 months after he had appeared on the cover of Time magazine in an article titled, Is Steve Bannon the Second Most Powerful Man in the World? Bannon talked himself out of his own movement. Adding to his woes, Bannon is now ensnared in the Russia investigation after having boasted privately that he doesn't have a lawyer and didn't need one. In mid-January, he was issued a grand jury subpoena by Robert Mueller and faced 10 hours of questioning by the House Intelligence Committee. We don't really know what Steve knows, a person close to Bannon told me. Whatever it is, he's going to tell them. He's not falling on his sword for anyone. Bannon assured people he isn't done. He joked in private that he's had 3 marriages and nothing in life lasts forever. He holed up in the Breitbart embassy, his townhouse in Washington, D.C., wargaming his next move. "He's been going at the same speed since he left," an advisor said. According to friends, Bannon is courting donors for a dark money political organization along the lines of the Koch brothers' machine, and he's returning to the thing that got him into politics, filmmaking. Later this year, he plans to release a multi-part documentary about the existential threat China poses to America. Bannon's megalomania had always bothered Trump, but not enough to make Trump fully quit him. Their political instincts were aligned, a fact underscored by the drama over the allegations of sexual impropriety involving Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, and Trump's widely condemned remark that America shouldn't allow in immigrants from shithole countries. Even before Wolf, Trump and Bannon were on a collision course, competing for leadership of Trump's America. But their close ideological affinity could conceal that reality. In mid-November, as Trump flew back to Washington from his 12-day Asia tour, I accompanied Bannon to Japan, where he was giving a foreign policy speech at a conference for Chinese dissidents. "I'm not really a human rights guy," he told me as we boarded the plane in New York, "but this is a chance to talk to them about populism." A polite airline representative whisked Bannon and his entourage through Tokyo International Airport. Tej Gill, a goateed ex-Navy SEAL security guard with tattoo-sleeved arms, stuck close by Bannon's side. "I've had a couple assassination plots," Bannon told me. "I got it from an intelligence source." They were trailed by a short, barrel-chested ex-SEAL in a knit beanie, by a videographer named Dan Fluette, who co-wrote Bannon's documentary, Clinton Cash, and by a red-headed body man, Bannon's 26-year-old nephew, Sean. In moments, we were escorted through a VIP immigration lane and into an elevator that descended to an underground garage, where a motorcade awaited. Bannon climbed into the back seat of a black BMW 7 Series and sped off toward the Peninsula Hotel to catch a few hours of sleep. The rest of the staff followed in a pair of minivans. The next morning, Bannon was pacing in front of a packed auditorium in a squat building on the grounds of the Olympic Village built for the 64 Tokyo Summer Games. "I feel like I'm at a Trump rally," he said, pointing out a young woman wearing a Make America Great Again hat. For the next hour, Bannon held court, microphone in hand. "The elites in our country have been under a very false premise that as China became more prosperous and economically developed, that there would be an underlying increase in democracy," he said. "What we found out over the last decade is the exact opposite has happened." He speculated that dark, unseen forces are at work. Bannon's core message, a clueless, corrupt ruling class, many of whom, of course, reside in blue states, has sold out American workers to a hegemonic China, and it's up to a vanguard to take our country back before the world tips toward cataclysm, is the same, whether he's speaking to Alabamian Roy Moore voters or Chinese dissidents. But he adjusts his vocabulary to fit his audience. Here in Tokyo, he was in full prophetic mode. Bannon is a voracious reader who sometimes stays up until dawn powering through books, journals, and news articles, scrawling notes in a pocket-sized green diary as he goes. During our trip, he used downtime to read a Robespierre biography. This was evident as he freestyled about Hillary Clinton, the opposition, party, media, artificial intelligence, Thucydides, Hollywood, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, the opioid crisis, Boeing jets, Brown University, Brexit, the cloud, the Civil War, the Peloponnesian War, the American Revolution, the Great Depression, Churchill, Napoleon, Hitler, and J.D. Vance. "It's not going to be okay," he concluded ominously. "The world is on a knife's edge. We have what I call a long, dark valley ahead of us, like the 1930s. The message is that the world needs saving, but who's going to save it? If you looked around, it wasn't hard to see Bannon's best answer. 4 months ago, Bannon was a supporting player with a whiteboard and a telephone. Now he wanted to make himself the star, not only the chief strategist, but in many ways the candidate, the front man of his own movement. With his motorcade, retinue of advisors and security men, his Asia trip was a mirror of President Trump's. The insurgents Bannon has tried to recruit to topple Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, dubbed the League of Extraordinary Candidates, include former Arizona State Senator Kelly Ward, Blackwater founder Eric Prince, MAGA donor Foster Fryce, and Danny Tarkanian, son of former UNLV basketball coach Jerry Tarkanian, all of whom inarguably fall far short of Bannon's stated populist principles. Roy Moore was perhaps the most vivid example of Bannon's army of rogues. When I met Bannon at Kennedy International Airport, an hour before boarding the Tokyo flight, he'd turned the first-class lounge into a makeshift war room to save Moore's imploding candidacy. A few days earlier, the Washington Post had published allegations that Moore had pursued romantic and sexual relationships with teenagers in the 1970s while he was an assistant district attorney. A chorus of Senate Republicans, led by McConnell, was calling on Moore to end his campaign. Most worrisome for Bannon, the White House put out a statement that Moore should leave the race if the allegations were true. The situation and the various arrayed forces for and against Moore closely resembled two earlier crises Bannon had weathered with Trump: the release of the Billy Bush tape and the aftermath of the white nationalist march in Charlottesville. In both, Trump ultimately followed Bannon's tactical playbook, doubling down at all cost, with large success in the first instance and a highly questionable result in the second. Bannon let the White House know that he wanted Trump to back Moore, but Trump seemed reluctant at first. White House political director Bill Stapien reportedly told Trump to stay out of the race. The conventional wisdom was becoming that Moore was done and that Bannon was wrong this time. Bannon's frenetic pace was part of his strategy. "I realized if you're not out there for the hobbits, you're not in their lives," Bannon said, using his affectionate name for Trump voters. During the week, I traveled with him from New York to Tokyo to Palm Beach, Florida, for what was Bannon's first major profile since leaving the White House. He made a half-dozen speeches to conservative groups, hosted Breitbart's talk radio show, and helped market a new biography, Bannon, Always the Rebel. Inside the right-wing echo chamber, Bannon was still being lionized as a conquering folk hero. At one event, I chatted with an elderly man waiting his turn on the receiving line. He said if I could ask him one question, it would be, "Why aren't you president?" That had been a thought. In October, Bannon called an advisor and said he would consider running for president if Trump doesn't run for re-election in 2020, which Bannon has told people is a realistic possibility. Bannon has also remarked on the toll the office has taken on Trump, telling advisors his former boss has lost a step. "He's like an 11-year-old child," Bannon said to a friend in November. Not surprisingly, even before the uproar over Wolf's book, the idea of Bannon as a political figure, let alone a presidential candidate, inspired ridicule and venom from the Republican establishment. A prominent Republican described Bannon's crusade as a vanity exercise doomed to fail. "I think there was a lot of rage when he was in the White House," the Republican said. "Steve had to subsume his ego to Donald, who Steve thinks is dumb and crazy. With Steve, it's not about building new things, it's about destroying the old. I'm not sure he knows what he wants. A few hours after the Tokyo speech, Bannon's security chief, Tej Gill, escorted me and a group of Japanese television journalists up to Bannon's suite. Bannon was padding around the room in a black blazer over two collared shirts, quaffing a can of Pocari Sweat, a popular Japanese energy drink. Bannon's nephew Sean cradled a phone, asking room service to send up cans of Red Bull, but was informed the hotel doesn't have any. He asked for Cokes and coffee instead. "We have to get him revved," he told me. Bannon was revved already. "The Bush presidency is the most destructive presidency in history, James Buchanan included. It's not even close," Bannon said when I brought up the Bushes. "And by the way," he continued unprompted, "I haven't even gotten to 9/11. I mean, 9/11. Think about 9/11. Think about if 9/11 had happened on Trump's watch. We would have gotten 100% of the blame by the Bush guys. And they said, well, we just got here." "What do you mean you just got here?" "That's what gets me about them coming after Trump. I really detest them. I mean, the old man is a pervert. He's a pervert, grabbing these girls and grabbing their asses." Since we'd arrived in Tokyo, Roy Moore's prospects had dramatically worsened after news outlets reported overnight that Moore had been banned from a shopping mall in the 80s because he cruised for teens. "He's denied it," Bannon said. Despite the new headlines, Bannon was confident that his strategy was working. He sensed he had a deep understanding of the electorate. "This is Alabama," he explained. "The age of consent is 16 for a reason." Bannon's conviction was forged from surviving the darkest moments of the 2016 campaign. "This is exactly like Billy Bush weekend," he said, "so I've heard it all and seen it all." During our conversations, Bannon proudly told me multiple times how he'd counseled Trump not to back down after the Access Hollywood tape leaked. He recalled how Reince Priebus, then chairman of the Republican National Committee, had told Trump he would lose an historic landslide if he stayed on the ticket. On Saturday morning of Billy Bush weekend, he tried to pitch Trump to get off the ticket. Bannon said, "I'm like, are you insane?" A producer motioned that it was time to start the interview. He excused himself and sat down with a fresh cup of black coffee. Billy Bush weekend cemented Bannon's bond with Trump. But when Trump became Mr. President-elect, the relationship became much more complicated. Trump was deeply galled that the media portrayed Bannon as the wizard behind the curtain. "I like Steve, but you have to remember he was not involved in my campaign until very late," Trump told the New York Post. In July, Bloomberg Businessweek journalist Joshua Green published a best-selling book, Devil's Bargain, that gave a substantial amount of credit for Trump's win and overall vision to Bannon. Trump tweeted in response, "I love reading about all of the geniuses who were so instrumental in my election success. Problem is, most don't exist. Hashtag fake news. MAGA. Meanwhile, Trump World, which had been unified by the shared goal of defeating Hillary Clinton, cleaved into warring factions within hours of Trump's unexpected win. On election night, Bannon said he disagreed with Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump over the content of Trump's victory speech. Kushner and Ivanka wanted it to strike a tone of unity, whereas Bannon wanted to keep up the attack. "I didn't think it was the right time to talk about uniting," he said. "I think some of that stuff comes off as phony." To Bannon, a former naval officer who scrapped his way into Harvard Business School and Goldman Sachs, Kushner was a callow elitist in way over his head. "He doesn't know anything about the hobbits or the deplorables," Bannon said. "The railhead of all bad decisions is the same railhead, Ivanka." According to a person close to Kushner, Trump's son-in-law viewed Bannon as a leaker at best, and a racist at worst. any chance that Bannon and Kushner would salvage a working relationship collapsed over Kushner's role in the decision that many see as the possible linchpin of Trump's downfall, the firing of FBI Director James Comey. It's the dumbest political decision in modern political history, bar none. A self-inflicted wound of massive proportions, he later said. But a White House official responded, especially in light of recent news, for the country, the president's best decision was firing James Comey. His second best decision was firing Steve Bannon, bar none. The blowback from the Comey firing pitched the West Wing into another crisis. On the following Wednesday, Bannon was meeting with Chief of Staff Priebus in Priebus's office when Kushner walked in. Jared came in and really had a hissy fit because he can't get mad like a guy, Bannon recalled. We have a communications problem, Kushner told him. No, we don't, Bannon shot back. We have a decision-making problem. We make a lot of bad decisions, and the bad decisions have to do with you. The relationship between Kushner and Bannon worsened through the spring. At one point, Bannon said, Trump called an Oval Office meeting to broker peace. Attending were Bannon, Kushner, and Ivanka Trump. She blamed Bannon for the leaks. She's the queen of leaks, Bannon argued back. You're an effing liar, Ivanka said. Trump tried to adjudicate, but the meeting did little to diffuse tensions. By this point, it was clear to many that Bannon was on the way out. He had told people the presidency changed Trump. He's an accommodationist, Bannon told me. Trump's tendency is to always get Maggie Haberman in there. He reads the New York Times. To him, that's the paper of record. After he was pushed out of the West Wing, Bannon began his political operation. But his campaign against McConnell further complicated his already fraught relationship with Trump. During a phone call in October, according to a source, Bannon and Trump debated for 15 minutes about who should get credit for Arizona Senator Jeff Flake's decision to retire. The following month, perhaps as an act of trolling, Bannon reportedly encouraged Trump's nemesis, billionaire Mark Cuban, to run for president as a Democrat. Bannon's transformation from political advisor to a quasi-politician also transformed Breitbart, where he served as executive chairman. It became a site that promoted his campaign. On the day of Bannon's Tokyo speech, his name appeared in 7 different headlines on the homepage. In December, Bannon signed a deal to host Breitbart's daily satellite radio show. But not everybody at Breitbart was on board with this synergy. According to sources, CEO Larry Solov and Breitbart editor-in-chief Alex Marlow did not want Bannon back. Marlow disputes this characterization. Solov did not respond to a request for comment. Rebecca Mercer, Breitbart's billionaire benefactor, was also concerned that Bannon's political crusade to defenestrate McConnell was fundamentally at odds with his role as a news executive, a Bannon ally told me. Steve thinks he can do everything on the planet all at the same time, the ally said. One question people raised about the Wolf book is why, given Bannon's position at Breitbart, he gave so many interviews to Wolf, a journalist whose career was spent at publications in New York City. The answer is that Bannon developed his power by spreading his message far outside the right-wing media bubble through the cultivation of journalists. My own experience with him illustrates how he operates. In August 2015, I received an email from Kurt Bardella, who at the time handled Breitbart's public relations. Thought I'd reach out and just say that if you ever wanted to talk with Bannon on background, I think he'd def be willing to touch base with you, Bardella wrote. I was shocked by his note, and also intrigued. For the previous 3 years, Bannon had tried to destroy my professional reputation. During this time, I was researching a biography of the late Fox News chairman Roger Ailes. A notorious paranoiac, Ailes waged an elaborate campaign to discredit my book that included having me followed by private detectives and commissioning a 400-page dossier about my life. Bannon and Breitbart played a crucial role in the effort. He worked out of Fox News headquarters, strategizing with Ailes about how to attack my book. Breitbart published many thousands of words about me, at turns calling me a Soros-backed attack dog, harasser, stalker, and Jason Blair on steroids, a reference to the former New York Times fabulist. After one Breitbart article, my wife and I received a threatening phone call at home. We called the police. A few days after Bardella emailed, I met Bannon for lunch at the Bryant Park Grill in Midtown Manhattan. I found him at an outdoor table, wearing an untucked shirt and cargo shorts. His hair was a tangled nest of platinum gray, and it looked as if he hadn't shaved in days. If I didn't know him, I'd have thought he just rolled off a bus at the Port Authority. Bannon shook my hand graciously. He told me he'd enjoyed my book on Ailes. What about all the hit pieces he published? Ha! Those were love taps, dude. Just business. We proceeded to have a highly entertaining lunch, swapping media and political gossip. Much as I wanted to loathe Bannon, the Breitbart attacks were genuinely terrifying. I found myself liking him. He was strange and charismatic and slightly unhinged, and he possessed a sophisticated and encyclopedic knowledge of the modern political media landscape. He personally knew the players, from the on-air talent and programming executives to the candidates and billionaire donors, and he was a gifted talker. He exaggerated, but didn't quite lie, at least most of the time. And during conversations, he fired off laser-accurate descriptions of famous people that would make the best insult comics proud. In that way, he was like another New York blowhard, Trump. In the days leading up to the Alabama Senate election on December 12th, it looked as if Moore would defeat Doug Jones. Bannon flew to Alabama to celebrate the victory, but when he saw the exit polls, he told me he knew the night wouldn't go his way. The percentage of write-ins was at 1.5%. I looked at the pollster right there, and I said he's going to lose this, Bannon recalled. He blamed McConnell for orchestrating the announcement by Richard Shelby, Alabama's senior senator, on CNN the Sunday before the election that he hadn't voted for Moore. That was the inflection point, Bannon said. Moore's loss further damaged Bannon's standing with Trump. The president was annoyed Steve lost the Alabama seat to a Democrat because Steve thought he was a big shot, a White House official told me. Meanwhile, Bannon's critics gleefully framed Alabama as proof that Bannon's political acumen has been vastly overstated. Then came Wolf. Bannon had just finished hosting his daily Breitbart radio show when he received an urgent email from an advisor. It was the morning of Wednesday, January 3rd, and Donald Trump Jr. had just called, furious over quotes attributed to Bannon that appear in Fire and Fury. The Guardian had obtained a copy and was reporting that Bannon called Trump Jr.'s June 2016 Trump Tower meeting with Russians treasonous and unpatriotic. The shocking comments from Trump's former chief strategist seemed to suggest the Trump campaign colluded with Russia, or at least tried to. The advisor warned that Bannon risked his political future if he didn't issue a statement walking them back. This is the president's family, one Bannon ally told me. While Bannon had granted Wolf extensive access, letting him sit on his West Wing couch for months, He was caught off guard by the book's rollout. He hadn't seen the Guardian piece. "What does it say?" Bannon emailed back. Working from the Breitbart embassy, Bannon quickly organized a series of conference calls with his kitchen cabinet, which included, among others, political advisor Andy Sarabian, Breitbart Washington editor Matt Boyle, communications strategist Arthur Schwartz, and Breitbart London editor Rahim Kassam. According to sources briefed on the conversations, Bannon denied making the comments about Trump Jr. to Wolf, but was resistant to the idea of issuing a statement disputing them. Steve was like, "I don't respond to bullshit attacks," a source said. Bannon declined to comment. The other people on the line told Bannon he was badly misjudging the situation. "Steve can be kind of delusional," the advisor told me. Bannon's camp had been in touch with Trump Jr. and White House official Ira Greenstein throughout the morning, and they were told the president was preparing for war if Bannon didn't recant. Reluctantly, after much lobbying from his advisors, Bannon agreed to draft a statement. According to a person who viewed the draft, it said Trump Jr. was a patriot who loves his country and went on to trash Wolf. A copy was sent to both the White House and Don Jr. and was approved. The plan was to release it to Axios' Jonathan Swan, but Bannon had waited too long. Around 2 p.m., Trump released a blistering four-paragraph statement ripping Bannon and questioning his mental health. "Steve Bannon has nothing to do with me or my presidency. When he was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind," Trump said. The level of vitriol in the press release reflected the contempt Trump had built up for Bannon. But as some advisors had warned, Bannon's situation deteriorated rapidly as the coverage of Wolf's book went into nonstop rotation on cable news. On Thursday, at the urging of White House Communications Director Hope Hicks, Trump allies fanned out in the media to attack Bannon. Some of the candidates Bannon has pledged to support in 2018 distanced themselves from him. Trump, meanwhile, kept up the attacks. "Sloppy Steve has been dumped like a dog by almost everyone. Too bad," he tweeted. Worse, Rebecca Mercer released a statement saying her family hadn't spoken to Bannon in months, won't support Bannon's political agenda, and remains committed to Trump. The Mercers are major investors in Breitbart News. Mercer, who almost never speaks to the media, released it after being lobbied by Trump, the Daily Beast reported. The New York Times reported that the Mercers cut off funding for Bannon's security detail. Bannon's position at Breitbart had become precarious. CEO Larry Solov and the widow of Andrew Breitbart, the website's founder, reportedly held conversations about whether Bannon should be removed as executive chairman of the company. One concern, according to sources, was what firing Bannon would mean for the site's lucrative contract with Sirius XM Satellite Radio. By Sunday, Bannon recognized how isolated he'd become. He emailed a statement to Axios' Mike Allen. "Donald Trump Jr. is both a patriot and a good man," Bannon wrote. "I regret that my delay in responding to the inaccurate reporting regarding Don Jr. has diverted attention from the president's historic accomplishments in the first year of his presidency." A Bannon advisor said it was a first step toward trying to repair the Trump relationship. Another ally said that Bannon felt he'd been quoted out of context, and he had sympathy for Don Jr. "Sometimes Steve does the right thing, even when he doesn't get anything out of it," the person said. It didn't save him. On Thursday, Solov announced that Bannon was out as Breitbart's executive chairman, as swift and stunning a fall as anyone can remember. One Breitbart staffer told me Bannon had become a distraction. The very next day, the White House announced that Trump was going to Davos, and in a meeting with congressional leaders, apparently designed to showcase the president's mental acuity, he signaled that he was open to comprehensive immigration reform. Bannon's nationalism was in decline, and Kushner's globalist agenda appeared ascendant. Bannon's insatiable need to dominate by talking, to make himself the hero of his own story, it had become clear, was a pathology, and his own words may describe his catastrophe best. It's the dumbest political decision in modern political history, bar none, a self-inflicted wound of massive proportions. In Steve Bannon's view of history, it's always 1933, but he projects an unrelenting optimism about his own future. It's a salesman's gift, one he shares with Trump. Create enough chaos, and the world will realign. Or it won't. This time, Bannon has blown himself up. "We'll never take him back," Kushner told a Trump advisor. Bannon broke his cardinal rule, never apologize. It's a place he's been before. For all his success, his career has been punctuated by epic blow-ups. I think the hot tub with the acid in the apartment in Florida is sort of where it always ends with him, a prominent Republican said, referring to a home Bannon once rented that was found trashed after he moved out. But Bannon, according to confidants, believes he and Trump might reunite. In Trump world, all relationships are transactional, and nothing is ever over. As Trump's base shrinks, and with Democrats increasingly likely to retake the House with the specter of impeachment looming, there's always the chance he will call Bannon back. Asked by the Wall Street Journal if they could ever reconcile, Trump said, "We'll see." This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.